Otamendi! And Liverpool lead!
The Premier League is back, and Off the Ball is the only place you can hear live commentary of Liverpool's march to the title, the battle for the Champions League places, and the fight for survival. Every big game exclusively live between now and the end of the season, starting this Wednesday from 7 p.m. with Manchester City against Arsenal. Yeah! And we'll also have live score updates on the OTB Sports app. OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the OTB Sports app.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Okay, you're very welcome along. It's Wednesday night rugby on a Tuesday. We have Premier League commentary tomorrow. We have Manchester City Arsenal for you. So we have decided to bring forth rugby by 24 hours. We have with us Keith Wood and Brian O'Driscoll. They are two lambs to the slaughter. We have forced this upon you. I mean, there's no two ways about it. This is not your first choice way to spend the next half hour. But we decided, with rugby beginning to happen again, the opportunity to do these kind of discussions is hopefully dwindling. So with 20 years gone in the 21st century, we are forcing you to pick your Irish 15. I know, Brian, in particular, you're very excited about doing this. When we called you to do this, you were waiting for this call.
I am. It's taken 6 years to get here. I felt as though I hadn't alienated enough friends in the first 6 years of my journalistic career. So I thought I'd probably try and go all out now and naming just, 7/6 of a back line. So yeah, straight away, I'm going to have my number deleted out of maybe 10 people's phone books. So yeah, looking forward to that. I have too many friends anyway. I'm really lucky that way, Joe. I've always been someone that's had 60 and 70 really close friends.
You are passing the book shamelessly on the number 10 decision. Is that what I'm hearing?
There's no shamelessness about it. The necessity to hold on to at least two friends is more important than any Ireland 15 in the 21st century. So I am 100% guilt-free passing on the number 10 selection to Keith Woods.
Okay, excellent. Well, we're going to have Keith pick the forwards plus the number 10, and then Brian is going to pick the back.
I don't mind swapping someone in the pack, Woodsy.
You're a gutless coward, Draco. I can't believe that you said you stood beside them, but you won't hold one over the other.
You see, one of them would probably take it okay. The other one
would.
Which one? Joe, that's your line to take over.
I actually don't know which of them would take it well. Who would take it better?
Sexto would take it better.
Right. The other fella mightn't talk to you for a while.
For a while being, yeah. But it would always be a grudge forever. Like, it would be an underlying grudge. You'd probably get back civil again, but it would never be the same.
So are you saying that you're just afraid to make that call because he'd have a grudge against you? Is that it? Straight up.
What makes you think that he's the selection, that Sexto's the selection?
Yeah, because I know what
we'll
you're
never,
saying.
We'll never, never know.
It's
a question I get asked the whole time on social media and sometimes at some of our outside broadcasts, our road shows, and I've managed to swerve by it thus far, and I'll continue to do so. So let's press on.
Let's press on. And, well, we'll get your thoughts on various players. So you come in on Keith's choices. Keith, you come in on Brian's. So where do we want to start? Who wants to go first? Keith, do you want to kick us off with our pack?
Should we go one and one?
Oh, it gets very confusing. The graphics department will have a nightmare here as they're trying to put them.
They're flat out at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah.
We'll go 1 to 15. We'll go 1 to 15, Keith, so you can get us moving. Brian, we're going to give you one veto in this pack, by the way. Now, come in on all the players by all means. And
do you want me to veto at the end or do you want him to veto at the end? Okay.
At the end. We'll let Keith do his eight, but you give us, I mean, you've played with a huge number of these guys as well, so give us your thoughts as we go on. I was proposing an executive decision whereby number 2, Keith Wood, would be chalked in and number 13, Brian O'Driscoll, would be chalked in. But you would like to pretend you're both injured for the day and we'll do it that way. Okay, great.
Yeah. We are both injured now, so that may qualify as well. So,
like a lot of players in this team. Okay, start us off then, Keith, number 1.
Well, I looked at a few different elements first just to try and figure it out. So some of the criteria, longevity, playing, numbers of standout performances, whether they were winners, also line selections. So if we were winners, I definitely wouldn't be picked. So that was one of the parts of it. So I look at it, Keen Healy for number one. Do I go straight from one to eight?
No. We can talk about Keen for a second. Oh, yeah.
Massages.
Keen Healy. So it's Jack McGrath, and of course the claw that you'd have to kind of put in as one there at the end. But he only played very little within it, and even though he was a tight head at the start, he moved to loose head. But I actually think the level of performance is the standard that Keen Healy has had over I don't know how many years he's played, but a huge number of games.
Does Marcus Horan not get a mention ahead of Jack McGrath?
I don't think so. And Marcus Horan got and played and got a Grand Slam in 09. But I think in terms of standard of performances, and we were saying if you're putting all these guys up together, like of course I lose friends with Marcus in saying that, and I'm not wearing my provincial jersey in terms of this conversation, but thanks for stirring the pot just there a little. But I just think Keen consistently has played at a very high standard. And I also love the fact that I thought he was drifting away 2 or 3 years ago. I thought his standard was going. I thought Jack was kind of going past him, but he fought back very well. I think prior to lockdown, the last 12 months before that, I think he's had some fantastic games coming back from injury.
Where were you on this one, Brian?
Yeah, I think it's a no-brainer for me. Keen Healy all the way. More so to Keith's final point there of looking as though it was a career-ending injury a few seasons back, you know, had no movement in his arm. And to rehab that back, you know, get the relevant surgery and then come back and hit some of the form he's hit over the last couple of seasons is quite a remarkable turnaround. His longevity as well. I played with him first time in 2006, I believe. So, you know, for someone to begin so young and still have that attrition rate that he's, and, you know, he's shown is quite remarkable. So for me, it's one of the clearest decisions on the 15 that you go with Keen Healy.
Okay. Keith, if you had to, in a line or two, boil it down to his biggest assets or what defined him as a player?
I thought he is a very good scrummager. He's a block of a unit, but he consistently gets that side of the scrum up when it's needed. But he holds an unbelievable amount of pressure. But it's his ball carrying, because you need to have guys at the three different roles. And it often would be a hooker who'd be a ball carrier. But for nearly all his period of time that he was there until Tadhg Furlong came along, he was the main ball carrier in that front row. And it just gives a better balance to the team when he does. But I think he's got the whole package. I think his line-out lifting is fantastic. His defence is fantastic.
Okay. I think one final thing to add, if I may, I think one area that has improved dramatically over the course of his career is his ball handling. I think he was prone to knock-ons. If the ball wasn't right in the breadbasket, I think he was prone to putting balls down, thinking about the collision before he had it in his hands. So I think that's an aspect of his game that has developed massively under Joe Schmidt and subsequently under Stuart Lancaster and Leo Cullen. So from an evolution as well and changing the type of player he is, I think he's more about footwork now than bludgeon. And yeah, he's one of the easiest selections on this 15.
Okay, very interesting. I guess that's one of those things you probably only notice when you play with someone, as in you know the ball isn't quite right and this player is more liable maybe just to fumble it, but he's improved in that area.
And scrum halves know that too. They know what, you know, to put a bit of sympathy on a pass depending on who their forward runner is. They know that certain guys have, you know, shovels as hands to be able to pluck the ball from anywhere and everywhere, and other guys just need a little bit of sympathy on the pass because they're more focused on trying to make that hole rather than actually having the ball in their hand. They take it for granted, and sometimes you need to start with step one.
Yeah.
Okay. There's also an effort in the front row or an element in the front row. Scrummaging is horrendous. It just takes everything out of you. So by the time you get out of that scrum, you know, they always say you're sprinting out of the scrum, but your first step or two is a walk. You're trying to get yourself almost fully oriented again as to where you're going. So that takes a period of time to get used to it. Also, front row forwards in particular, are spending half their time in the gym. That doesn't lead to subtlety in your hands. You know, you need to have a level of flexibility as well. So anyway, I think he's a class act and has been.
Okay. At number two then, Keith Wood is injured.
Thankfully injured in this one. Look, you can talk about Gerry Flannery and Shane Byrne, of course. You can talk about Frankie Sheehan a little bit, but no, it stand out again, Rory Best. And from being all the way back from 2005 to playing to last year, and I still think he went on too long. But I think the quality of his performances, he's had a lot of downs in his career. And one of the reasons for that is he played for 14 years. It's very hard to keep a high standard all the time. So he had down periods of time, he days when things didn't work very well for him, but he fought back time and time and time again. And I think he was there for a huge amount of the big games that Ireland won. And he delivered on a lot of those big games that Ireland won. And for me, he's hands down top notch.
And if we park longevity for a second, just for a second, say this is, because we can all have different criteria and this is the team of the 21st century, but say it's a team to go out and your mortgage is on this one match. Does Best still emerge then over Flannery and the others?
In my view, he does. I think Flannery was a pure line-out thrower than Rory was, but Rory wasn't just the player, he was a captain. And he was also able to get an awful lot out of the players around him. But I'd go back to the previous point when there were big games that needed to be won, having never beaten the All Blacks, for winning Six Nations matches, for winning championships, Grand Slams. He consistently brought himself out to a high level of it. And on one of those years in particular, he was a shocker for Ulster. He wasn't able to raise his game for Ulster in one of those years. I think it was about 3 years ago. They weren't winning. Things were really, really kind of tough. And yet when he put on the Ireland jersey, he was able to lead Ireland to the front. And so I would always pick him.
Okay. Brian?
Yeah, I think it's a bit closer than that, to be honest with you. If you're, you know, longevity is the calling card for Rory in this selection, along with his captaincy. I think in the teams that he played in Ireland, he wasn't one of the best players. He was kind of middle of the road, I would have said. But yet there were other attributes to his game that guaranteed his selection, and that calmness and that leadership and that understanding as to, you know, when to speak to referees, you know, when to calmly speak to his team behind the posts. I just think he nudged them in the right direction, and it coincided with, you know, him taking over from Paul O'Connell after the 2015 World Cup. It was a fruitful period for Ireland, but he has to take a huge amount of credit because of the leadership he showed during that period of time as well. But I do think that Gerry Flannery is absolutely in that conversation, more so than the other two. I thought I played underage with Gerry Flannery, and I played for a couple of years at Ireland. If he didn't have the run of injuries that he had, I think, you know, his name would be thrown around a little bit more as the quality player that he was. His line-out throwing was exceptional, one of the best around. But what people won't appreciate with Gerry was he was a standard driver as well, and he was a fitness driver. He was all about work rate. And that Munster success in 06 and 2008 was largely, people talk about Paul O'Connell and, you know, some of the other names, but Gerry was someone that drove that standard massively and always talked about fitness. And even to this day, he's a fitness freak. You know, he's always punishing himself. It's in him. It's that desire that I think is very hard to replicate if it's not, you know, in you initially. So I think Flaz absolutely right up there in that conversation because he's a Grand Slam winner as well. And, you know, those calf injuries were the end of him. And, you know, he had a few more years left of him for sure.
Okay. Your tight head then, Keith?
Tight head again. Well, it goes down to two guys for me. One being John Hayes. John started in 2000 in the second game in 2000 against Scotland. He played 100 odd times at prop, which is quite amazing. He was 6'3" and a bit for a tight end, is very, very tall. He was under pressure because he was tall. But I love playing with him because he was unbelievably honest. And if he got beaten to the hit, he would still fight to the nail, and he'd often get screwed in that scrum if he was in a wrong position because he was such a big man. But he changed a lot of Irish lineouts for the simple fact that he could lift any man. It didn't matter whether they were light or not. He could throw them up on his own. And often at times defensively, he'd lift Malcolm O'Kelly on his own. So I'd be a huge fan for what he actually did at a time. For a guy who just wasn't the right size for that position at that time, I just think he delivered so far beyond what he could have done. He was an incredible defender. But if you're looking at pure tight heads, it's Tadhg Furlong. I remember he must have been 15 or 16, and for some reason he was related to the postman in Killaloe who'd said, you need to watch out for this guy, he's my cousin or whatever he was. He said, this guy is just phenomenal, wait till you see him. And obviously he didn't see him for a few years, but ever since he's come on to it, he was brought in very early into Leinster, brought in early into Ireland. His standard of scrummaging and in really, really big games has been truly phenomenal. And that's what he's there. That's what he's there for, scrummaging and lineups. But then the subtlety in his hands. I mean, he is an absolute 21st century ball playing front row forward. Some of the skills, some of the capabilities he have are phenomenal. And I just think he's a standout player. He is beyond all others in the three jersey.
Yeah, I'd say if you say Tadhg Furlong to a lot of people, Brian, they think of the hands even in the 2018 Grand Slam game at Twickenham, and that's the difference.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, he brought ball playing into the Northern Hemisphere in the front row. Probably we'd seen it in the New Zealand team, seen it in aspects in Australia, but he was the first real ball playing tight head prop, I think, that we'd fully appreciate, where you have to respect multiple facets to his game. You know, he had that ball carrying ability, but when you have that subtlety of, you know, to play, you know, the front door option or pull the ball out the back, or as we saw that little slip pass with CJ Stander for the try in the England game, like all of those little nuances, you know, are practice, but they're also in you. And I agree with Keith. I think John Hayes was a vital cog to the successful Irish team in the 2000s. And success is slightly different to our modern day version because, you know, we'd no platform to have built success from before that. Whereas this team in the second decade of the 21st century, you know, expected to win. We didn't. And John Hayes, when he was injured, we were in trouble because back up to him was not to that standard. And his ability to stay in games for 75, 80 minutes was, a massive catalyst to our being able to stay in games with teams where previously we would have fallen off at 55, 60 minutes to be able to scrummage the way he did. And he wasn't the world's greatest scrummager, but he locked it down. And he was tough. He was farmer tough. So, I have a lot of love for John Hayes because of, he was kind of quietly went about his business and wasn't about the, you know, the adulation or the backslapping. It was just about enjoying rugby and winning. And then off he went home to his family and his farm, which I love about that.
And he never complained. And he never blamed. He never said it was somebody else's fault if he was in trouble in the scrum. And sometimes it was, actually. But he never complained at all. Mm. And it was amazing. And by the end of his career, he wouldn't go to post-match functions. He'd go home. You know, he'd play his match. He'd be absolutely knackered at the end of it. And he'd go home.
He didn't hang around for day two after the Grand Slam. He watched the trophy lift on Dawson Street from his couch.
Yeah.
I'm not going to that.
I love that.
I would have added an expletive there, but I know that we're on.
Tadhg Furlong selection has turned into a John Hayes love letter, but that's fair. So give us your. We'll pick up the pace a touch. Give us your second.
This is like selection. A feature film.
Yeah, give us your two here, Keith, in the second row.
Well, the two in the second row. Now, there's lots of guys that sit in the background here, but the two. I'm just going to go for the two straight out standout performers, which is James Ryan and Paul O'Connell.
Hmm.
Only for the reason, if they overlapped at any stage, you would absolutely pick both of them anyway. They'd always fit in. But I remember O'Connell coming on as fiery-headed, angry young, and he was really angry, and he was trying to push standards very early, which was great and annoying in equal measure. And he was, as some of us were trying to get our way to the end of our career, and not try to burst every gasket. And but he had a fantastic standard. And like you talked about Gerry Flannery and work ethic, Paul was work ethic. And at times at the start, I think that went against him because it was work ethic over some of the efficiency that you would need. And once he got that balance right, which he got pretty early in his career, he suddenly started putting out these world-class performances time after time after time. And for me, one of the reasons I love watching him play, love playing with him, was that it didn't seem to matter what jersey he had on. You know, so the raw emotion that he had for Munster was the same that he had for Ireland, was the same that he had for the Lions. It was a different jersey, a different canvas under which to play it with, but he still had that same level of emotion coursing through it. But his proficiency then at line-out in particular, at breakdown, at tackle, ball carrying, and he wasn't a fast guy and he wasn't a big powerful guy to do it, but he was able to manage his own body to be very effective, to get over the gain line, to delay the ball, to get, you know, so that the rest of the team could get in on top of him to make certain that became quick ball. And I thought he consistently led from the front. So without even talking about his captaincy, you would pick him very, very quickly. James Ryan has just been, it's like Paul O'Connell, the new version 2.0. He has started almost nearly where Paul finished and he's taken it on from that period of time. And he is raw, but he puts in huge shifts, often too much, I think. I think we play him all the way to the 80 minutes, and I wish at times that we wouldn't, because we want to make certain we get another 10 years out of him. But I think his play, his tackling, his ball carrying is more heavy than Paul's is. But I think he is a pure class act, and we're only seeing him for the last number of years. So I'm hoping we get to see him for a long time to come.
Yeah. So O'Connell, we don't need to elaborate on really. On Ryan, Brian, Warren Gatland was in the studio last year, and we touched on who might play in the second row. And the two names which he went for were Itoje, and hopefully Alwyn Jones is still going. And I prompted him, and Ryan, he said, oh yeah, Ryan, of course. Yeah. But it made me wonder, have we all got more excited about this guy than the rest of the world is?
I think probably a bit. I think maybe a little bit, but maybe people haven't been paying attention as much. I think when you look at the quality of Itoje, who's been there, done it already, one Lions tour, Alan Wynne Jones, been on three Lions tours, and you know, been hugely successful. You know, for Wales captain. It's hard to shake those personalities. Yeah. So I can understand that to a degree. And on the biggest stage, other than, you know, yes, beaten the All Blacks, and yes, Ryan is a Grand Slam winner, but I think he's still in his infancy in gaining that worldwide respect. I think it's getting there, but I think it's not quite there yet. Whereas we think he's absolutely one for the ages. And I think we're right. I do think, you know, if he can avoid injury, he's going to be one of the great second rows. There's aspects. I think he's cut from a similar cloth to Paulie. I think he possesses an aggressiveness now that I didn't know before that England game. Obviously, O'Connell was in camp before that, and he got in his ear, and you could just tell, even, you know, in a team that was going backwards, he seemed to be the one aggressor that we had. And there was a concern. I had spoken about a concern of just lacking that little bit of dog in that pack, but I absolutely saw it in him, which was very exciting as well. It's another string to his bow. I think handling and his decision-making is what sets him apart. He doesn't make any bad decisions, and he's got magnificent hands. I think he's got better hands than Paul O'Connell. And he is a different type of ball carrier, because it's all close quarters with him, and maybe that's to do with Ireland's game plan. But we have seen him out in the open spaces as well, and he's very comfortable, you know, and he's got a turn of speed too. So I feel as though that yes, there's others that might make the conversation, but they're all playing for second. Those two are standout performers in the 21st century, no doubt whatsoever. And yeah, I think we've got some exciting times ahead of us with James Ryan. I'm sure he's destined to be an Ireland captain himself. And it'll be interesting to see. I agree with Keith. I think you can't expect him to continue playing the game that he's playing at the moment and get 10 or 12 years out of him. It's too attritional. He's going to have to look at adapting his game like a Skulk Burger, where he becomes a playmaker rather than that, you know, that ball carrier that takes all the punishment. And because he's doing it for 75, 80 minutes most of the time, that's fine for a young fella. But when you get to 27, 28 and all the injuries start taking their toll and it's sore to get out of bed, you just won't be able to continually do it and expect to play 25, 30 games a year. It's not going to happen. So he needs to look at that, and hopefully that'll come with a game plan and a strategy from his provincial and national coaches in the coming years.
Yeah, I also think it's a blend of the other players that are around you. If he has to be the main ball carrier, I would rather other guys to do that and to pick and choose the really important ones that he does. I do think his decision-making is excellent. I used to say for a very young Paul, Paul wanted to hit every ruck and carry every ball. And you do have to figure out and pick your moments, not too much. But the structure of the game has changed a lot in the last sort of 15, 17 years, where now an awful lot of the game is actually already not preordained, but everybody knows exactly where they're going to go. So you can pick a good line knowing that you are going to be the ball carrier, as opposed to stumbling over some other players who get in your way. And so he just needs to make certain that he carries 7, 8, 9 brilliant carries a match, not 16 of them, because you have to share the load. Otherwise, you don't have these guys for a long time.
So Keane Healy, Rory Best, Tadhg Furlong, James Ryan, Paul O'Connell. Keith, give us your back row.
My back row is David Wallace, Sean O'Brien, and Jamie Heaslip. And I went for those because it was a big toss-up for me now between David Wallace and Peter O'Mahony. And I think we may lose a little bit in line-out by not having Peter O'Mahony there. And I think he has been phenomenal for the last number of years, and I'm a huge fan of his. But I actually thought David Wallace was, if we were to try and play a game where you were all over the field, David Wallace's pace in the back row was just without parallel. I remember a speed session or a speed test in 1999 where he hosed you, Draco. I actually remember the scores, and he hosed everybody else too. He was the fastest guy in the squad at that stage. And to have a guy as big as he was and as effective as he was something. Sean O'Brien, I love Sean O'Brien as a rugby player. I just think he is hard, grunt, incredibly powerful, very, very skillful, reads the game very, very well, has been plagued with injuries at the end of his career. And yet I think they almost define him, and he was phenomenal. Jamie Heaslip's a really tough one for me. So Anthony Foley was a fantastic, very, very smart number eight, really, really good. CJ Stander is the go-to guy in Munster and Ireland, and has been for a long time. And I got very frustrated with Jamie towards the end of his career, but he was playing what was required by the coach. But when I go back to 09, 10, 11, 12, I actually thought he played truly phenomenal rugby at that stage. He read the game very, very well. I think he ended up playing a tighter game at the end, which I wasn't a huge fan of. But the amount of work he did day in, day out was pretty extraordinary. And I think with that balance, we may be losing a little bit of height, but that balance of that back row is incredibly ball-carrying and fast.
Okay. And on his day, at his absolute best, injuries aside, does Stephen Ferris feature in that conversation for you?
Yeah, he does, but that was a kind of brief flash in the light. You know, I thought he was truly extraordinary and destructive with ball in hand, or more especially as a car crasher of a tackler, and he really was. But I think we only got to see him for a short period of time. So I put it in as my criteria with some level of longevity. Some of the standout performances, mind you, in that period of time, if you're looking for a highlights reel, big hits, big carries, you'd put Stephen Ferris in there. And I think he's a very good player. Mm. But I don't think he's at the standard of the guys picked.
Brian, no mention of Dennis Leamy in the conversation?
No, I like Dennis Leamy. I thought Dennis was a fantastic footballer. He hated the fact that I wanted him to become a hooker. I thought he would have been an ideal guy to be a hooker. And he said, Woody, just please promise me you'll never mention that to any coach, because he was afraid of his life. But I thought he was made for it. And I thought he was good, fantastic footballer, really good thinker. I just thought the other guys were better.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a very nice back row, and it's you know, you can argue, you know, some very relevant points to it. I think Ireland's best back row that I've ever seen was the back row, you know, maybe before the quarterfinal of the World Cup in 2011, but that balance of Sean O'Brien at 7, Jamie Heaslip at 8, and Stephen Ferris on the blind side was looked really exceptional. When they were just the complemented one another, the cleverness of Jamie at 8, of mopping up all the, you know, all those crumbs, that was stuff that he wasn't appreciated for. He's another one that made great decisions, never ever got himself turned over, made others look good. He just filled in holes. Even though his skill level wasn't anything like of a Dennis Leamy, I just thought he was a very, very clever operator. So I think number 8 is probably one of the easier ones, and I'd definitely go with Jamie Heaslip. Sean O'Brien's getting in there, all right. It's just a matter of whether you want to play him at 6 or at 7. And David Wallace, I love playing. You know, Wally was the ultimate sevens player. He had that crazy speed, you know, speed repeat ability, explosiveness, you know, reasonable offloader. Again, maybe his skills wouldn't have been of the Leamy caliber, but a brilliant performer. So I think there's not much in it, but I feel as though the balance of Ferris at 6 with O'Brien at 7 and Jamie at 8 would just top Keats, back row of 3.
Okay, very interesting. There are forwards. Brian, we're handing over the baton to you. At number 9.
Yeah, this is probably my easiest decision. You know, you look over the course of the last 20 years and, you know, who's been there for this whole decade? Well, it's Conor Murray. He came in probably ahead of perception in 2011, got into the World Cup side, as a third choice scrum half, and it only took, you know, to right after that tournament for him to stamp his authority as the number one. He'd come in as number one in Munster that in and around that time. It was just the changing of the guard with him and Strings, but I think his consistency of performance over the first 7 or 8 years of this decade, of the last decade, makes him one of the better scrum halves in the world. People talk about him and Aaron Smith for many years as the best two scrum halves in the world. I think it's hard to argue with that. Brilliant, brilliant decision maker. Again, a bit like Jamie Heaslip, but a 2.1 version of that, of being able to read the game and plug in where Ireland were deficient, particularly in defence. I think the best defensive scrum half that I've ever played with, and probably potentially ever seen. He was phenomenal, not only at realising where the threat was, but also actually making his tackles as well. Very, very rarely fell off tackle. Big man, you know, 6'1", every bit of 6'1", and he packed some punch. Pretty powerful in the weights room as well, and he didn't leave that behind there. So, great passer of the ball, incredibly good box kicker. Obviously, the last couple of years have been slightly disappointing, where he's been carrying that shoulder injury, and he hasn't quite hit the lofty heights of 2013 in particular, and 2017. But with honourable mentions of Peter Stringer, obviously, you know, it was an outhouse passing dream. And Owen Redden, who came in and kind of was a bit of a stopgap between the two of them. But I think Conor Murray is definitely the standout performer at number 9.
It's good to get your summation of him there, because if you ask anybody in the street what's Conor Murray really good at, the first thing they would say is box kicking. you know, and actually it was relatively late on in your list there of all the other important attributes. So,
yeah, I think defensively is what, for me, you know, it's that defensive intellect is what, you know, it's all well and good wanting to make tackles, but you got to know which tackles to make and where the threat's going to be and being able to read it ahead of time. And I think he's someone that sees the game unfolding very well and identifies where the threat's going to be on the next phase, because he's able to scan quickly and see numbers versus numbers and where, you know, where there might be a grubber kick and what line he needs to charge through. His ability of support play, playing ahead of the ball as well. I know all scrum halves are doing that. But, you know, picking up those, second touches to allow players get back to their feet. It's just the small nuances of his game, I think, is what, you know, the players that play with him probably enjoy him more than those that watch from afar. And, you know, cool as you like, I just think temperament is to die for as well. He doesn't do stress. Mm. And, he quietly goes about his business, but I felt very, very comfortable having him in my team.
Okay. Now, as well as this going out on the radio, this will also go out on YouTube. So a fair proportion of the YouTube viewers, once we started this, skipped forward to about halfway through because they wanted this debate about the number 10. And that was the one in the office.
Leave it to last just so we scupper them.
You should watch the whole thing.
Graphics. I'm thinking of the graphics department here. No worries.
You can't. Millennials are so lazy. They'll only do 2 minutes of any YouTube clip. So let's drag it out.
But just before we get there anyway, Joe, I think we just need to highlight Stringer again. Even though Connor is very calm, he's brilliant and he manages the game very well. And actually, I liked the leadership of Owen Redden. I think he was a very, he was a thoughtful nine, which was very good. Stringer was a revelation. He had the most unerring pass. And I wouldn't have said he was a great decision maker because his decision was nearly always to pass. But he would hit it where it would get the maximum effect out of you. So I would know if I called for him, he would say, well, you've made the decision, I don't have to worry. If it's the wrong decision, it's your fault because you made it. But he'd hit it. He never, ever passed the ball to my hands. Never once. He'd sling it out in front of you and you'd have to accelerate onto it. So I liked running onto the ball, but my God, he'd push you to the full level for it. And I just thought he changed how we actually played at that stage, upped a huge gear for the simple fact that you were always running onto the ball because your half trusted the fact you would do so.
You should know as well. You were in the 10 position more times than I care to remember as well. So you'd actually know the quality of pass probably more than Roger Humps.
Well, you were very quiet. So you never wanted the ball to score a try at the end, you know? When nobody is talking, somebody has to.
Get the head wobble going.
Absolutely. You're dead right. If not, why not, you know? But I loved Benjamin Stringer. So I wouldn't have had as much joy with Connor, that's for certain. But
I agree with you on the Owen Redden thing as well. I think he was a real Jerry Flannery of the Leinster setup as well. He was a standard driver and someone a pre-season that just demanded a huge amount of the players around them. So I agree that that's what he brought. And stopgap is probably a bit unfair because he brought on, you know, it was an evolution of a passing game from Strings before Connor came in and was able to plug in everything and just do all of those aspects a little bit better than Owen. But yeah, I think a decent mention for the two of them, but for me, Connor Murray.
So Keith's going to make the ultimate choice here, but Brian, you start us off with O'Gara and Sexton and give us as detailed as you like a comparison of their game strengths, weaknesses.
So I think if you think about clutch initially, I think you think about Rog, about because of, you know, the drop goal in 09, it had to happen for us to win the Grand Slam. Stepped up, didn't, you know, never thought about, you know, another phase. That was his chance and pulled the trigger. I think he was someone that grew into the game. He had to fight for his position a bit like Sexton did with him. You know, he had to fight for it with David Humphreys. It's unfair to say that he was a kicking number 10, but he played the corners and the percentages better than anybody else. He was a forward pack's dream of knowing how to have a ball on a string, putting the ball in behind wingers, and forcing pressure on the opposition to get after their line out. Particularly during that period of time, we would have had a good defensive line out with Mallow Kelly and with Paulie throughout those 2000s. So, you know, Rog was very, very good passer of the ball. Probably didn't quite play to the line the same way that Johnny is. Not as much of a threat as Johnny was. Although, you know, not afraid of having a go himself, because he didn't have the physical strength that Johnny had. I don't think teams probably worried about him quite as much as they do Johnny carrying the ball. Defensively, obviously, Rogers' tackling wouldn't have been the strongest part of his game, but he was incredibly brave. But I think physically, Johnny's tackling, and you know, we spoke about it before, concerns about him going high the whole time, his tackle technique being a bit questionable, particularly when he was appeared to be getting those head and neck injuries. But he, again, equally brave, but had the capacity to throw the shots in, and that choke tackle became a thing of him and Henshaw and Darcy over the course of the second decade of the 21st century. So, yeah, they're quite different players. I think Johnny was able to... They both had brilliant vision, identifying space, were willing to play from wherever. And I think you always had to be on your toes, that there was a quick tap potentially coming your way from anywhere if the opposition switched off. So kindred spirits that way. But I think probably a bit more attacking with Johnny and a little bit more of a kicking 10 with, you know, without being disrespectful to Rog. So slightly differing styles, but, you know, incredibly effective, both of them. And of their time as well, I think there's been, the game has changed dramatically, and maybe they would have had an adaptive ability to be able to play in each other's decade a little bit more.
Keith, pick up on some of those points and what's in your thinking.
I think the last point is they were players of their time. And I think, and players for their coaches, actually. So I think Johnny Sexton has been pretty phenomenal under Joe Schmidt in particular. He has a like-minded coach who thinks out the game and the manner under which it should be played and then delivers on it and has done it incredibly well for all that period of time. I think Rog was coming almost from the end of amateurism. He was a young kid coming through the system. I think in many respects it might even be hard for him to get through at the present moment in time. Once he'd get in there, I think he'd deliver, but it's very hard to get that start now. And he was given a start, and he had a lot of down days. He had a lot of days when he didn't put them over. And you remember, like fans often only remember the great days at the very end when he was putting them all over. He was a fiery character as an out half. Both of them were actually, both were very fiery, and they could be riled and could be bitchy. And
they still are.
And they still are. And they actually have an extraordinary body language. You could just see it immediately how they are. And they have a face on them, you know, when things aren't going right. And even a face on them when they seem to be going right, but not as right as they would have liked them to have gone. I look at both of them. I think it's incredibly tough to measure between them. I'm still a little bit disappointed that Brian has chickened out as a coward. But if I was looking at it, the only thing that marks one out over the other for me was the amount of knocks that he got early on in the career. And I'm not doing this with a red jersey, but I would pick Rog. To deathly silence.
You know, to counter it and to try and throw an extra bit of balance, you know, you got to take into account that Johnny was World Player of the Year as well. He's beaten the All Blacks 3 times, drawn with them once, you know, won a Grand Slam, won other Six Nations titles too. So from a medal haul point of view, I think Johnny obviously wins there. I think it's a tough call, but So I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, I like the fact, I'll still go back to Raj. I like the fact that he was there for an awful lot of it. He was there from 97, 98, 99, when Munster would have been a poor team, when Ireland were poor, when there was no sense of success. He was there for all of it. He was chopping and changing with David Humphreys for a fair bit of it. He stayed the course to get there, but he stayed the course with his hand on the tiller for Munster to get to 06 and 08 and deliver it on those days for Ireland to win the Grand Slam in 09. He was at that stage of a two, I would have said, with not as good a team as Leinster and Ireland had in the sort of 04, 05, 06 period of time. Or sorry, 15, 16, all that period of time. So I'm not saying it was easier for Johnny, and I think you could decide on one or decide on the other. But for that alone, and for that length of time, through the bad stuff first, and through the missed finals and semi-finals, yeah.
Okay, here we go, moving on.
One last quick point. And Keith, does all that stand for, a bit like with the Rory Best Flannery question, one game, your life depends on it. I mean, Brian outlined Sexton's physicality, taking the ball to the line more. We didn't mention the Lions career as well he had versus Rogers Lions career. So one game on the line.
Yeah, do you know what? I just wouldn't, like, I'm happy to sit in the fence with Brian on that. I actually wouldn't have any issue having either of those guys. If you were looking back and saying one of those guys was kicking it, I'd be comfortable. Okay. I just wouldn't have an issue with that idea. Actually, some of the arguments we're having here are so fine on some of the players that you're saying, yeah, you'd be very proud to be in that team with either of them.
Yeah, because I feel like Brian's body language is betraying him right now.
So do I, actually.
Of a sulk about this decision. I feel like he wants to say a bit more.
No, because I'm okay with either, provided my name's not
associated with it.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, and not just because of my friendship with the two lads. It's not solely to do with that. It's because you can argue the point for both of them because they both achieved. You know, some people would say that perhaps Rog had a greater Munster career than he did have an Ireland career and kept them in the mix. You know, people would say that Johnny didn't have the clutch kicking early on in his career. You know, he missed the one against New Zealand in 2013, but then he knocked over that drop goal against France to set up the Grand Slam. So there's counter arguments to everything within this.
It's
a very, very difficult call. And you're right, Keith's right, you'd be happy to play outside either because, you know, they're both incredibly clever footballers and they'd put you in the right parts of the field.
Okay. So Keith goes for Rog. That's our number 10. So Murray and O'Gara. Who's your number 11 then, Brian?
Yeah, not an easy one, this. And again, if you're looking at, you know, at different aspects to try and come to a decision, you know, achievements, honours, longevity is a big one here. And to stay the course for over a decade, somewhat at times in and out of the team on the wing, because there tends to be quite a lot of turnover. There's lots of fast players out there with great footwork. And so of all positions, it's quite hard to stay on the wing in the back three for a very long extended period. You look over the course of history, there aren't that many players that stay in an international wing position for 10, 11, 12 years because there's others that come in that, you know, are able to showcase it in a season and replace them or displace them. So on the basis of that, it's a tough call, but I'm going to go with Keith Earls. I think he's found his best position undoubtedly on the wing. It took a while to get there. There's lots of jumping around at 13 and 15. I think he learned a lot in playing in the 13 jersey. And I look back to the World Cup in 2015 and I think it was a wrong call playing him in the 13 jersey in that quarterfinal. And he probably learned a huge amount from a defensive perspective. And I think as a result, he's got a huge appreciation as a winger now to be able to understand the expectation of what's what's in the 13's job description, and so he reacts very well. I think defensively, decision making, he's very, very good. One on one at training, we talk about it the whole time about how he would have made us look silly at times, and sometimes that didn't always translate itself onto the park. But then, you know, I think we have to wait till his 29th to 30th year for him to be, you know, the player of the season. I think in Slam year, incredibly consistent, runs in lots of easy scores for Munster, but he runs those lines time and time again. Doesn't seem to have lost a yard of pace. Brilliant footwork. A better kicking game now, really worked on that. So if you're talking about, you know, other potentials, you talk about Luke Fitzgerald because he's been a Lion as well and a test winger for the Lions in South Africa. I think it's a close call between the two of them for me. You talk about the current crop of Jacob Stockdale. I think he's in the next conversation because, yes, he had that incredible 1 year, but I think we've seen slight frailties to his game since then, and he needs to bounce back from that. And if he wants to be a Keith Earls type to play in that jersey for 10 or 11 years and continue having that firepower. So, I think Keith Earls just gets it for me. People okay. don't, again, he's someone that when you train with him, you have a greater appreciation, a bit of a Conor Murray. And some people are like, I don't get it. I don't get Earls. When you see it on a daily basis and see how devastating he can be, I think it excites you as a teammate to try and get the ball as often to him as you can. And yeah, he just shades the 11 jersey.
Okay. Let's continue here with our all Munster back line. Who's at 12?
Rob Henderson. Rob Henderson doesn't get in. At 12, we're going with... we're going with my old teammate and centre partner, Gordon Darcy. I couldn't have gone with anyone else. I guess, you know, I'll do the more than notable inclusion in this conversation is Robbie Henshaw, obviously, with his pretty consistent performances. He's been dogged with injuries, and so maybe he hasn't had a run of games that, you know, you would have expected from him when he broke onto the scene. But I think Gordon Darcy, for his ability to come back from serious injury as well and just a consistent performer, I had a telepathy with him and a real appreciation for what he was doing. I saw him miss one tackle over the course of his career on Rougerie, which, you know, no man should be left one-on-one with him anyway, so it was probably bad defending from me. But he was a very good tackler, incredibly brave in you know, the jackal position, turned over so much ball, worked hard as a centre pairing where we had to split, where I had the seniority and I used to get him to, you know, to get up off the ground and break to the far side when you'd be trying to split after first phase, and he worked hard an awful lot in that regard. And he was someone that it came a bit easy for him at the start and had to reinvent himself and then had to wait a long time for that second cap to come after multiple disappointments, and then turned into the consummate professional and someone that was there for a fast track, but also for the trenches. So, Gordon Darcy at 12.
Okay. Any qualms with those two thus far, Keith, and we'll keep moving?
No, not at all. I remember Darcy coming on the scene pretty much straight out of school, and he was a star, and he had his head nowhere in the right position to be able to play. He was picked at fullback, he was picked on the wing, neither of which suited him. It took him a long time to get the start, really, in 2004, where he got into a partnership where it would work. And I thought he was a perfect foil for Brian for all that period of time. So he did a huge amount of work, but he also covered an awful lot of the inside, things that would never even happen, but there was a high level of empathy between the way both of those players played, and as a combination they were pretty phenomenal. So yeah, no, absolutely, he gets it.
Okay, Brian, you're injured. Who's at 13?
I'm going to go with not a brief mention, but a mention where it feels as though we got a sense of what he was capable of in Jared Payne. And I think he was the glue of that initial Joe Schmidt team at 13. Other than that head injury that he initially picked up in the World Cup, I think in 2015, I think he was one of the biggest losses of all of those mentioned, of Paul O'Connell, Johnny Sexton, Sean O'Brien, I can't remember, there was someone else big in there, but I think Jared,
maybe as well.
Yeah, I think Jared Payne was potentially the biggest loss, particularly as it transpired in that World Cup. I think his cleverness at 13 and his understanding of the game, I think you look back to the game against the All Blacks in Chicago, I think his centre performance with Robbie Henshaw was one of the great performances that we've seen in an Irish jersey. So more than a small mention for him. And you can see his cleverness as a rugby player now being translated into a coach and the defensive system that he's set up in Ulster as well. And clearly a very good communicator. I think that's one thing that Johnny Sexton would always have said. Backline sometimes got a little bit quiet when you start losing a few players that have been there a long time, and then he stepped into the fold and it became a simple transition to connecting the inside backs with the outside backs because of his voice. But just because he was only there for a year or two, I've got to go with Gary Ringrose and the excitement that he brings when he gets his hands on the ball. I saw him at a very young age, right out of school, when he trained against Ireland in the Six Nations camp, and immediately you could tell he was something special. And then when he came back 2 weeks later, because he'd been dropped from the under-20s team, I was appalled and shocked that that could have happened, because he was ahead of his time with angles of running, with seeing space, with understanding defensively when to come, when to stay out. And this is only as a 19-year-old. So he was always destined, to be fast-tracked. And I remember, saying that when he'd just broken into the Leinster team, that Ireland could do worse than pick Gary Ringrose against England in the Six Nations. And I was laughed at. Yeah. Well, he became a seasoned international about 6 months after that. And he's had the occasional dip in form, a few injuries too, but he's someone that makes things happen. And I think when he's flying, Leinster and Ireland tend to be flying as well. And they just need to get the ball. I don't think the game plan under Joe Schmidt suited his game particularly. And I hope that he gets more space in the outside channels, because that's his game. He's someone that has that little goose step, has the ability to beat players one-on-one, has a good passing game, a good offloading game. Like I said, very good at reading things defensively. Statistically, he'll go down as missing a lot of tackles, but don't read into that too much. He shuts down space an awful lot and forces teams back into spaces they don't want to go. So, yeah, I think Gary Ringrose has a very exciting 6 or 7 years ahead of him. A great pro by all accounts as well, and a real student of the game, which his attitude would lend you to believe that he's here for a very long time and could be really great player.
Okay, very interesting. Keith, do you share that hope that he might flourish a bit more in the post-Schmidt era?
Yes, I do. And I do like the kind of looser aspects of his game with the ball in hand, which he rarely gets the chance to see. But he's a lovely ghosting into space if he can pick a right line. But he hasn't been given that opportunity for an awful lot. I also think he suffered quite heavily from following on from Brian. So he's a fantastic player, but he often gets compared with the guy who went before him, and that makes it pretty tough.
So, Brian, give us your last two then, or we'll be here all night.
Yeah, okay. Last two, I'm going to go in with both of them. It's a difficult one at 14 because, friendships aside, I thought Shane Horgan was a fantastic player on the wing, who was ordinarily a centre, but then got played on the wing for his first ever outing there at international level against Scotland back in 2000 and made it his own. Brilliantly skillful player, again, read the game brilliantly, but unfortunately didn't get the just rewards for that, 9-10 year period, eight years in the international team. And just as he came out, we won that Grand Slam. And who'll forget Tommy Bowe's performances in that Grand Slam, then subsequently playing for the Lions that year and 4 years later. So I think Tommy Bowe, on his finishing capacity, his defensive reads just shades that one.
Because he wasn't lightning Tommy Bowe, was he?
He was quicker than everyone gave him credit for. You know, I think he got a bad rep. He mightn't have been like Dennis Hickey fast.
Yeah.
But he still had proper wheels, and Tommy wasn't the most elusive of players, but he was strong and had a good offload game as well. So he didn't pass the ball a huge amount, but he offloaded it, you know, very effectively. But yet, you know, you wouldn't have been, you know, you think about other wingers where you'd be sitting down on your heels like Jason Robinson because you don't know what way he's going to go. I think Tommy had a big right foot step. You mightn't have known what it was coming, but it was pretty explosive. And, you know, for those that didn't think he was that fast, he still put it to good effect and scored a lot of tries for Ireland. So I think Tommy shades it over Shane Horgan. And then at fullback, I'm going to go with the guy that's been there forever since 2008. Disappointment of the World Cup in 2007, not getting in the squad. But he made the position his own from 2008 until the World Cup in 2019. And that's Rob Kearney. He had his detractors as well, where, you know, he didn't have a counter-attacking game. You know, his passing game wasn't up to scratch. But what he did for that period of time with offering security at 15, I don't know. I've never seen an Irish fullback achieving that. Also, you have to remember all of the big games that Ireland have won over that period of time, Rob was involved. I think there's one English game that I can remember Jarrod Payne playing at 15. But other than that, Rob Kearney was the common denominator in all of those successful days. So his very, very strong. He mightn't have been the most elusive counter-attacker, but always broke the first tackle. Very good kicker of the ball. You know, the most educated left boot you could hope for. Positionally, almost unrivaled. Gervin Dempsey might run him on that regard, but Rob could see and read the game brilliantly. And particularly under Joe Schmidt, the expectation was to cover a huge amount of grass. And I think you're seeing it with Jordan Larmour, that the ball bounces a little bit more with him back there than it does with Rob Kearney. And that's because you see body language and players shaping with that little bit more experience that Rob had. So notable mentions, Jordan Murphy, Gervin Dempsey, you know, Simon Zeebo, but I think for me it's one guy and it's Robert Kearney.
Okay. Keith, do you want to swoop in with any vetoes on this back line?
No, because my veto was going to be if he'd gone in a blue jersey at 10, I would have gone in with the red jersey of Raj. But no, I don't think so. I like it. I don't feel the need to argue with it. I do think Zeebo offered something very, very different, but would have been incredibly frustrating. And actually, Brian mentioned one word, was the security at full back. All you ever want as a forward is to know that when the ball is up in the air, someone's going to catch it. He caught everything. I think it took him a while to figure out whether he should kick or run. And sometimes he would run everyone in every game. Then he'd kick everyone in the next game. It took him a while to figure out how that would happen. But ultimately, he scored a lot of tries too. He's been on the end of an awful lot of stuff. But he has been a comfort blanket for that team for 13, 14 years.
Even when he made bad decisions and when it wasn't on to counter, he rarely got turned over. He had this ability to fight in the tackle and wait for the security to come and take care of that ruck. Very, very strong, stronger than he looked. And, you know, he was probably too much of a hole runner at times, where if I was to pick holes in him, he ran into space when holding his width and holding his depth would have worked a little bit better. But again, I can't say, you know, when it was put to him in Chicago that he needed a big performance against the All Blacks to hold on to his jersey, and then he went out and got man of the match. I think that speaks volumes for the temperament and the ability to rise to the challenge. And every time he was, you know, being written off, he came back with big performances. So that longevity and its testament to his ability, his mental resolve to stay in the fight and absolutely maximize, you know, his abilities.
Were you tempted finally by the speed of Dennis Hickey in there at any stage?
Of course, but I loved a super fast winger, but I think, you know, Dennis came back into the team in 2000, but then wasn't always a starter. You know, I look back to the grand, the Triple Crown in 04 and 06. I don't think he started in either of those. I think he might've been the 23rd man and on the bench. So I think just on the basis of someone, yes, Keith Earls has been in and out of the team, but I think he's been in more often than not. And again, it's to do with that Grand Slam winning game, I think back to that year and how well he played for Ireland. Starting with that crossfield, you know, catch against France to set up that drop goal opportunity. Like, it just, yeah, I'm a big fan of Keith Earls. I always have been. So, I mentioned for Dennis Hickey for that crazy gas. There's something lovely about putting some into space and know they're not going to be caught. But Keith Earl had that elusiveness as well and incredible fight in the tackle too. So, yeah, I mentioned for Dennis Hickey for sure.
So, Keane Healy, Rory Best, Tadhg Furlong, James Ryan and Paul O'Connell, Sean O'Brien, Jamie Heaslip and David Wallace, although Brian's veto sticks in Ferris for Wallace. And then we have Conor Murray. We have Keith Wood going for Roger 10. And then we have Earls, Ringrose and Darcy, Tommy Bowe and Rob Kearney. Done. Happy? Turn off your phones.
It's a pretty decent team, actually.
Strong team.
We take that team, yeah.
Strong.
Like, we could tidy up everything if we just put a bench out there, you know. But you'd be happy to be on that team, wouldn't you?
Wouldn't you just, yeah.
Okay, very good. Thanks, fellas. Much appreciated.
Cheers, gents. Good
Thanks,
luck.
Thanks, Woodsy.
Bye.
Put your jersey back on. Bye.
Bye, Mac Driscoll.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.